Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. One of my favorite authors is John Steinbeck. And of all his wonderful books, my personal favorite is The Log from the Sea of Cortez. And I'm not alone. Generations of marine biologists and oceanographers were first inspired by reading the story of Steinbeck and his best friend, marine biologist Ed Ricketts, and their crew as they traveled from Monterey down the Pacific coast of Baja California and into the Gulf of California. It was actually Ricketts that kept a journal of the voyage, and later his best friend Steinbeck turned these notes into an epic story of marine biology, travelogue, and the newly emerging philosophy of ecology, the interconnectedness of the web of life in the tidal zone. For years, fans of Steinbeck and Ricketts have wondered what happened to the boat that was the central character of that story, the fishing vessel named the Western Flyer. One man, our guest, John Gregg, became obsessed with finding her and restoring her if possible. After years of searching, the geologist finally did, and you're going to hear about the epic story and Gregg's plans for the famous boat. Gregg joined us from his offices in the Bay Area. John Gregg, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Happy International Podcast Day, I think.
All right. Well, my first question for you is, when did you first discover the book, The Log from the Sea of Cortez?
Oh, it was a kid. I think I was 11 or 12 and couldn't understand very much of it. And I kind of picked the book up by mistake. The whole story is I lived in rural Georgia and we didn't have a library, and I think it was Jackie Kennedy had set up this bookmobile program for kids in areas with no libraries, and it would come by and you'd have just a few minutes to grab five or six books, and I just grabbed for anything that smelled of adventure, and I saw this book with a boat on a green sea, and I grabbed it thinking it would be some, you know, voyage to the bottom of the sea type book, and it wasn't that, but it was almost better because it described this situation where, you know, people were ostensibly doing science, but it sounded like a lot of fun. They were, you know, friends going down there and having these adventures and discussions and still doing something that seemed worthwhile and seemed like that was an incredible way to make a living. And so I was hooked.
It's funny you recount that story because I had a similar experience. My first Steinbeck was Cannery Row, and I got it off a bookmobile in, of all places, Paradise, California. It was the same kind of program where the bookmobile came and, you know, you got to go on and look for a book, and it looked like it wasn't too big a book to read and had a kind of a neat cover, and it sounded like fun, and I read it. I really enjoyed it, and especially the character of Doc. And then that's when I wanted to find out more, and that's when I discovered The Log from the Sea of Cortez. For our listeners who may not be as familiar with this as we are, tell us a little bit about this journey that John Steinbeck and his friend Ed Ricketts went on in 1940. Just kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of what they did.
Yeah, well, the background probably can't talk about without talking about The Grapes of Wrath, which Steinbeck had just published. And he grew up near Salinas in California, and he was firsthand witness to some of the things that were happening as far as the refugees. Well, they weren't refugees. They were people moving out from the Midwest to California to look for employment and work. They were escaping the Dust Bowl, and they were coming by the thousands. And in fact, there was a camp that Steinbeck visited I think it was near Lost Hills, where he said there were 5,000 people that were basically starving. They were eating grass and bark and things that, and he couldn't believe that was happening in California. So he was pretty outraged and wrote the book and instantly was labeled a communist by the farmers and you know, the established business people in Salinas. And so they were burning his book, and he was just outraged. And in fact, he said he was done with the novel, and he didn't want to talk to anybody about it. There was death threats against him. And so he thought getting away would be a good idea. And Ricketts thought it would be a good idea too. He just finished. Ricketts had a habit, like a lot of marine biologists, of not being very circumspect with who he slept with. So he was on the run from some angry guy in Monterey. So they thought going to Mexico would be a good idea. And collecting specimens would be a good way to pay for the trip. They had another reason they talked about, that the Hoover Dam had been constructed and had stopped all of the fresh water coming from the Colorado River into the Sierra Cortez. And they wanted to document what it was like near the start of that, and see if they planned on going back later and see if there were any effects of the water being cut off.
And for our listeners, the Sea of Cortez is also known as the Gulf of California, the body of water between Baja and mainland Mexico. And it's one of the most biologically fascinating places on Earth, isn't it?
It really is. And it was called the Gulf of California back then, too. Steinbeck preferred the Sea of Cortez just because he thought it sounded more exotic. So it really is an amazing place. It's still to this day, although it's been, you know, overfished and water temperatures are rising so quickly that the biology is changing permanently, it seems.
Yeah, you know, when you say the Gulf of California, it doesn't sound as magical as the Sea of Cortez.
Yeah.
And, of course, they had to charter a boat, didn't they? So tell us about the boat they chartered.
Well, Steinbeck went down to the docks and thought it would be easy to charter a boat because the sardine season had just ended and the boats were just sitting around. And it turned out he was so disliked by the fishermen because of his, you know, they really did think he was a communist then. Nobody would rent him a boat. So he had a relationship with this guy named Toby Street that he went to Stanford briefly with. And Toby was a lawyer and had some connections with a family that owned one of the boats, the Western Flyer. The Flyer was made in 37, and back then no one really had money, so they did these weird ownership deals where, you know, the boatyard would retain ownership and the captain and the crew would work and pay back the yard over time. And so there was several owners of the boat, and so Toby Street could exert a little pressure and talked him into renting the boat to Steinbeck.
And before we go on to talk some more about the Western Flyer, which is, of course, central to this whole story we're going to be talking about in this episode, is tell us a little bit about the relationship between Ed Ricketts, this marine biologist, who is one of the early proponents of ecology, and his understanding of tide pools and the life that lived on the coast of California where he was collecting specimens, and his influence on this great writer, John Steinbeck, because you can argue that with no Ed Ricketts, we may have never heard of John Steinbeck, can't you?
I think so. Ed Ricketts seemed, and it's funny because since I've been involved with this project, a lot of marine biologists, I would almost say all marine biologists know this story, and I didn't know that. And they all are more interested in Ed Ricketts than John Steinbeck. He seemed to be a person that just kind of defies characterization. He was sort of wholly without any judgment. So he was just as happy talking to the working girls across the street from the lab as he was with, you know, the eminent Stanford biologist that they would come around. He just didn't really care. He talked to everybody the same. He even, you know, saluted dogs, and dogs, you know, everybody said that dogs smiled at him when he walked by. He was a pretty amazing person. He was schooled in Chicago, but never finished university there, and ended up walking to escape a jealous husband from Chicago to Charleston, South Carolina. And the whole time he was walking, people were asking him what he was doing. He said, "I'll just walk in, you know, I just needed to get out of town." And nobody liked that answer. So he found it was better to tell people that he'd lost a bet. And then everybody was comfortable with him just walking. He was a person that had a really inquisitive mind. He just would, like, he had this butcher paper that he wrapped his specimens in the lab. And he wrote, without Wikipedia or Google or anything, he wrote everything that he could find that had ever happened in human history, all the wars and famines and discoveries and music and this cramped little writing. And it went across all four walls. And he noticed there were there was a stair step type pattern to it, where there's periods of quiescence and then there'd be a jump in activity, usually following a famine or a war. There would be an uptick in art and music. And he wrote about it and talked to people about it. And it's what the biologist Stephen Jay Gould later called punctuated equilibrium. Like, evolution mm-hmm. doesn't happen in a steady state. It happens in fits and starts. And so he just thought different than other people. He didn't want to group animals in a tide pool in a normal taxonomic sort of order that all the biologists were using. He wanted to talk about them as living systems and how they related to each other in the tide pool, which was brand new back then. And so he was, the first to whisper about that. Back then, people thought that the sea was limitless and they would never catch all the sardines. And when they started slowing down, a newspaper person asked him one time, where did the sardines go? And he said, they're all in cans. No one could believe that back then, but it turned out he was right.
Yeah, he was prophetic. And he had the lab there in Monterey, which is the Pacific Biological Laboratories, which I always want to call Western Biological Laboratories from Cannery Row. And he had amazing parties there with, just people that are astounding to me. Like, for example, Joseph Campbell, who became very famous for, his work on myths.
Yeah, a lot of people would drop by and just like sit at Ricketts' feet almost and talk to him. And Campbell was one of them. He was, Campbell was very well educated and had studied in Europe under, I think, Jung or Nietzsche. I don't know which one, but he was very well educated and well funded and had some time. And he just hung around the lab for a long time. And Steinbeck talked to him about how every culture had a hero's journey, like the story of the Odyssey. And Campbell later wrote that into his Hero with a Thousand Faces series. And that became, I think, what George Lucas credits as his inspiration for the whole Star Wars thing. So, if you want to squint your eyes a little bit, you can say that might have originated in that dirty little lab as well.
Yeah, yes, that's true. And I've also, that dirty little lab is sandwiched there to this day between the great Monterey Bay Aquarium and these luxury hotels. And you see this little wooden building that's still there.
Yeah, it's amazing. People had the foresight to leave it alone. It's on really valuable real estate and everyone just knew that it was a special place and just left it alone.
And most tourists walk right by it having no idea that really is Cannery Row.
Yeah, it's amazing. Then you can stand right there on the steps and look around and see all of the characters that were in Cannery Row. Is the brothel and the Wing Chun grocery store across the street, and La Ida's, and the lot where the bums lived in the big boilers. It's all still there.
Do you recall the first time you got to go in there?
I do. Yeah, it's a funny thing. I was there very a long time, 1981, actually. I remember I was doing diver certification there, and I was there, and I looked from the outside, and I knew what it was, and I just thought, I got to get in there someday. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to think of something. And at that time, it was a kind of a men's club where some luminaries, and I think there was 12 or 14 people that ran it. And, among them were people like Hank Ketchum, the cartoonist, and doctors, and just sort of some very interesting people that were still around then and would hold court there every Wednesday.
Hank Ketchum, wasn't he the one that drew Dennis the Menace?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. And so you finally did get in there?
I did, yeah. I, once I was involved in the Western Flyer, I was invited into into that world a little bit. So it's been a real, real honor to be able to have access to some of those things.
Yeah, I've been in there too, and you really can just get the sense of the spirit of, you know, what happened there so many years ago in the 30s and 40s before Ed Ricketts was killed by that train wreck hitting his truck there on, was it Drake in Monterey, which was, you know, really affected Steinbeck, you know, for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and I was fortunate. Ed Ricketts had a son, Ed Ricketts Jr., who just died last year. But before he passed, I was able to spend some time with him, and he told me stories. You know, he lived in a lab for a long time, and they were really, really interesting to hear some of his stories and his accounts of the people that would drop by.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with John Gregg as he tells us about the restoration of the Western Flyer, the fishing boat made famous by John Steinbeck in the log of the Sea of Cortez. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our conversation with John Gregg as we learn about the restoration of the Western Flyer, the boat that John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts explored the Sea of Cortez on in 1940. Well, in 1940, John Steinbeck and his wife at that time, I believe her name was Carol, and Ed Ricketts and the crew, they go on this voyage to collect, like you said, to kind of get away from all the publicity that was going on with the Grapes of Wrath, down to the Sea of Cortez. And then this marvelous book comes out of it where we get to learn about this trip. And it's not just a tale of collecting marine specimens. It's about philosophy and the story of people that they meet. It's just this marvelous, amazing story. At the time, it wasn't very popular, but it's kind of like one of those things where over time, people start to appreciate things that are great, and to now it's like recognized as one of Steinbeck's, you know, marvels. But what I love about it is that it really was a collaboration, and Steinbeck refers to as a writer refers to the narrator as we, which is both he and Ed.
Yeah, he did. Steinbeck himself didn't keep any kind of a logbook on the trip. He just sort of experienced everything. The captain kept a logbook on where they were, at what time they were, and what the tides were. It was just very factual. But Ed Ricketts kept a long log on yellow legal paper and kept pretty exhaustive notes. And those notes still exist there at San Jose, and you can read them. And then basically a year later, Steinbeck sat in a chair. He was getting his portrait painted, and he would sit there with Ricketts' notes, and he wrote the main part of the log. And he, like, some of the things I see as source material in the notes of Ricketts, and what Ricketts takes 5 or 6 pages to describe, Steinbeck will do in 2 or 3 paragraphs. And that I didn't really know what a genius Steinbeck was until I saw that. I saw his source material and I saw what he ended up with. And it just really amazing what he could do and get the point across in so few words.
Yeah, it's just beautiful writing. It's Steinbeck at his best. Okay, so the Western Flyer is a purse seiner. Is that the way you pronounce it?
Yep.
And so tell us what a purse seiner is.
A purse seiner was built. They made the boats up in the Pacific Northwest. The main fishery was down in Monterey. They were catching sardines at the time, and the way they would do it is they'd deploy this big net, and it had like a drawstring at the bottom, and they would just pull on that drawstring after they surrounded a big school of sardines, and they would pull it tighter and tighter until they had a big ball of sardines, and then hoist it up on the deck and drop it in the hole. It was a pretty efficient design. The boat was truly like a hunter killer. There's a book the writer Kevin Bailey wrote called The Western Flyer that kind of chronicles the flyer's life after the Silla Cortez too. And the fishermen tend to do the same things. When one fishery is hot, they all go to it and they all participate in it and they all overfish it. And that was the story of the Western Flyer. It would go to a different fishery after the sardines were fished out in Monterey. It went up to the Pacific Northwest and caught a fish called ocean perch, which were really kind of a red snapper type fish. They were bottom fish that would live for 70 or 80 years and not reach breeding age until 15 or 20. And they were dragging these things up by the millions, and not only dragging the fish up, but they would hit a rock and it would come up in the net, and they wouldn't throw the rock back down because they didn't want to catch their net on it again. So they would put it on deck and throw it away somewhere else. So not only did they catch the fish, they wrecked the habitat so that the fish never came back. I talked to one deckhand that had worked on the Flyer during those days in the 50s, and they had a load of 80,000 pounds of ocean perch, and they were coming into Seattle, and the captain radioed, you know, what are you getting for ocean perch? And the shore radioed back, oh, a penny a pound for feeding to minks. And it wasn't worth going back to shore and burning the gas. So they emptied all of the fish just out in the sea, and their swim bladders were extended, so they floated. So the deckhand said, as far as you could see, there was this orange, you know, covering over the sea of these 50 and 60 year old fish that were, you know, just, and that's the way they did it. And they went after the ocean perch. They went up in Alaska and did red crab, and then back down to Seattle for salmon. And every fishery would last 7 or 8 years. And, you know, the boats were just very efficient hunter killers of whatever fish they were involved with. But the Flyer was weird. It would, between its forays as a fishing boat, it would get hired by the predecessor to the Fish and Game. One time, for example, the Portuguese were over off of, I think, the Pacific Northwest and very close to shore, and the Russians, and they were catching as many fish as they could, and it was making the local guys mad. So the Fish and Game Department chartered the Western Flyer to do a bunch of test trawls and see what the status of the fishery was. So it spent a couple years doing that, and from that information, they did I think it's called the Williamson Act, where they moved the economic border from 3 miles out to 200 miles in Magnuson Act, I guess, and effectively moved the fishery offshore. And that was all gathered aboard the Western Flyer. So,
wow.
Armed with that information of where all the fish were, as soon as it was done with the study, it went and caught as many as it could. So it had that weird life of alternately exploiting and exploring the ocean.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling to think of in this day of us trying to, you know, buy sustainable seafood in the market, for example, and the Seafood Watch program at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. This is that was just the most unsustainable thing you could imagine. I'd like to talk about your interest in this boat, because you and I love Steinbeck, and that boat, you know, figures in our imagination like it would for millions of Steinbeck readers. But you went about acquiring this boat and have. When did you decide that you wanted to do that?
Oh, it's one of those long stories that just sort of develops. You don't actively wake up and think, I'm going to get the boat. And it's just sort of a whisper of a thought. You know, you think, I wonder what happened to that boat. And pretty soon that turns into I'm a scientist. I do stuff in the water now, and would find myself in Seattle or in Alaska in different ports. And I would just always ask people, hey, did you ever hear the Western Flyer? And, oh, yeah, it was here and it's been crushed up, or, you know, just hear different stories. And I knew that it changed its name, and I just was sort of passively looking for it. And that turned into a little more, you know, of an aggressive search, and finally found it after I figured out it changed its name. So, and I don't remember a conscious decision to get involved in this. It just, one of those things that just developed over time.
Well, as I recall, there was somebody that tried to do what you did before to buy the Western Flyer, but then it was acquired by the person that you bought it from. Can you tell us about who owned it before you did it, and what happened to the Western Flyer? Because it was not a glorious ending to its career.
No, it wasn't. Again, it was going through its life. I didn't know it. It changed its name to Gemini in the 60s, which is kind of funny because it did have this duplicitous sort of life. The captain that owned it at the time was a real fan of the space program, and it was a Gemini program, and he renamed it the Gemini. So it turned out that a relative of Tony Barry's, a guy named Bob Ania, who lives in Monterey, was talking to his uncle, Tony Barry, the original captain, and right before Tony died, and was, you know, telling him he was having a hard time because Bob was looking for the boat as well. And said, you know, I can't find the boat. And Tony Barry, who is funny because he saved the Western Flyer on numerous occasions, he sort of saved it again because he said, you know, a boat never changes its radio call sign. So even if it changed its name, if you went to the Coast Guard records, you could find what it changed to. So Bob did that. He went and he found that the boat had been renamed the Gemini. And then he found it up in Alaska. And the guy that owned it, I think, wanted $40,000 for it. It was being used as a channel marker, I think, at the time. Wasn't fishing anymore. And so Bob went back to Monterey and tried to raise some money to buy the boat to return it to Monterey. And when they publicized it in the newspaper that the boat had been found and they were going to have this gala to raise money, and they weren't able to raise the $40,000 in Monterey. They raised, I think, $10,000. And one person that read that article was this developer named Jerry Kehoe, who owns some restaurants in Salinas, one of which was right near the Steinbeck Museum. And he thought if he had that boat, he could cut it into three pieces and put the bow in the bar and the stern as a dance floor and some other thing. And so he bought the boat. And then sort of tried to put his plan together for the hotel. And of course, those things take several years. And in the meantime, a plank sprung loose and the boat sank in her berth in Anacortes. And he raced it and had to pay some money for a small spill. And it sank again, I think, a few months later. And this time stayed on the bottom for about 6 months while people argued about whose fault it was. And so that was when I found it, when I saw in the paper that the boat had sank and this guy owned it. And there was this uproar about what should happen to it. And so I started calling Mr. Kehoe and called him actually for a couple of years before he would take a meeting with me. And then finally, I think the writing was on the wall that he wasn't going to be able to get the boat down to Salinas. So he was willing to talk to me about it.
And you had to bargain with him, negotiate to purchase this, and you paid a lot of money for this boat.
Yeah, it wasn't much of a fight, honestly. He knew the moment he saw me that he's just, you know, kind of a tough Irishman, and he's good at these things, and he knew I was going to pay too much for it the moment he looked at me, I think. And so since we both knew that, it was just a matter of time. So he wanted, you know, I think $1 million for it. And after many meetings and my brother kicking me under the table, that's what he got. So,
wow. And it was valued at what at this point?
Well, at less than zero, because when I went up to the boatyard in Port Townsend, the boatyard they're smart, you know, people abandon boats in boatyards all the time and they're left to clean up the mess. And they have a environmental cost of that. So they made me post a $20,000 bond, so I wouldn't skip town on, you know, leaving that mess in their yard. So I guess it was worth negative $20,000.
Oh gosh. Well, okay. So it's definitely worth beyond measure for money because of who she is and her history and what it means to you and for millions of Steinbeck and Ricketts fans. So now tell us where she is and what you're doing with her.
So, you know, I thought a lot about this and I'm not super sentimental about old things. And I don't think Steinbeck and Ricketts were either. They didn't like dead things. They didn't like mounts on the wall. They didn't like any kind of trophies like that. And I don't think they would like a dusty old, you know, museum relic, you know, just talking about their story. They were forward looking guys. And I wanted to do the same thing. So I thought, okay, if I fix the boat up, it has to earn its own keep. So, you know, I'm in the business and very troubled by the ocean health that, you know, there's a lot of problems as well publicized, and I'm in that business and see sort of the ugly side of it. And I know what's being done and what's not being done. And so I thought, you know, if I could use this boat and use it as an ambassador to, you know, approach people that weren't getting information in certain areas, then in exposure to science and art, that it would be a good thing to do. So we're going to repurpose the vessel. We're going to, you know, it's being renovated right now, restored, whatever word you want to use, in Port Townsend. There's basically being much of it's being rebuilt. The wood boats are different than steel boats in that wood boats are made of millions of pieces of wood, all of them different and with different lives. And they're all made to be changed out. So a boat, you know, you put 10 pieces of wood in it and one piece might last 40 years and one piece might last 20 years. And so they're like Lego sets and you just replace a piece at a time. But what I'm doing now is having to do deferred maintenance for, you know, 30 years of no pieces getting replaced. So we're replacing a lot of the hull. The house is remaining very much the same, but I wanted to put electric propulsion in it. For a couple of reasons, you know, one to demonstrate that it's cool and people should be doing it, but also electric motors give you station holding ability. You can stay in one place without putting anchors down very easily. And so we're going to have an ROV, which is a remotely operated vehicle that will go down and film things and do things underwater. So it'll be a nice blend of old and new, I think. So I'm excited about what the boat will do in the future, as much as I honor the past.
Let's take a short break. We're talking to John Gregg about the restoration of the Western Flyer, made famous by John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts in the book The Log from the Sea of Cortez. I'm Dave Schloem, and this is Blue Dot. Stay with us. Welcome back to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our conversation with John Gregg about the restoration of the Western Flyer, the vessel made famous by John Steinbeck in The Log from the Sea of Cortez. And I was reading that one of the problems with rebuilding her is that it's hard to find the kind of wood that she was originally built out of, this old growth Douglas fir. So where are you finding the wood to rebuild her with?
Yeah, that's been eye-opening and sad. You know, that boat was built like thousands of others right near Tacoma, and they didn't have to go very far to find that wood. But it's special wood. You got to basically the tree, and I didn't know any of this, but the trees basically need to live at above 1500 feet because the winter rings need to be a certain density, and they need to, you know, be clear without any branches for, I think 60 feet. And so there's all these rules, and you just can't find it anymore. The wood they were telling me that we could find that would be acceptable for planking would be, you know, old growth wood from up in Canada. And that didn't seem like a great idea. So I made this silly rule to have this NFC, this sustainably harvested wood designation that people have come up with. And so I also, at the same time, I needed to replace the planking on the outside of the boat. I needed to make the boat heavier because, you know, the boat was meant to carry, you know, 70 tons of fish. And now we're going to have that fish hold a lab space. So for weight and balance, I needed to add weight to it. So I picked a wood called Sapile, which is an African teak wood. And so there's a group in Germany that certifies that it was sustainably harvested. So my sustainably harvested wood went from Africa to Germany, went from Germany to get milled in France, and went from France to Washington. So the carbon footprint of my sustainably harvested wood is not great. So, you know, these are all things you learn.
Oh, darn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's, as they say, it is what it is. And at least you are, it sounds like you're trying to do things that in the most responsible way you can. And it doesn't sound very easy. When you project out, when the boat's done, which is what, in 2020, when is it going to be finished, do you think?
About a year from now, it'll be floating and good again. It'll take us a few months after that to fit the lab out and some of the ROV testing and some of that stuff. So,
can you give us a sense of what kind of lab your equipment, what you're going to have as far as this is going to be a scientific vessel? What are some of the things that you want to have on her?
So we'll have the normal suite of scientific oceanographic stuff, you know, where you measure temperature and salinity and all of that. And our ROV that will be able to go down full ocean depth, probably 4,000 meters, and do things. One of the things that I'm very interested in doing is deploying a series of data loggers up and down the coast. Basically, 1 year we're going to go north towards Sitka, which is the trip that Ricketts and Steinbeck were planning when Ricketts was killed in 1948. And then the other year we're going to go down towards the Sea of Cortez, and we're going to visit ports all along the way. Try to visit ports that don't get a lot of attention, smaller ports, you know, Fort Bragg and different places that, you know, people don't go and research vessels don't go. Here in Southern California, you know, and we have a ton of research ships available in Newport Beach and LA and, you know, San Francisco and Seattle. But the little ports, Tillamook and, you know, Coos Bay, they don't get a lot of attention. So we're going to go to those places and spend a few days at each place. And one of the things we're going to do in each place is deploy these data loggers that will measure the normal things, temperature and salinity and conductivity, but also pH. And pH is really hard to measure long-term in the ocean. The pH meters are, you have to calibrate them. They tend to biofoul. It's been a real problem developing. And a couple years ago, Wendy Smith has this Ocean X Prize, and she gave a bunch of money to the group that could develop a pH meter that would last for a couple of years. So that spurred development of some of them. So now we can put a pH meter on each of these data loggers. And that's really important because, you know, the ocean absorbs about 30% of the excess carbon dioxide. And it doesn't take a lot of change. And as it absorbs carbon dioxide, it becomes more acidic. And if you're a little, you know, foraminifera or diatom or some little critter that secretes a shell for your house, you know, and you're doing that out of calcium carbonate and the ocean becomes even slightly more acidic, you can't do that. Your house dissolves as soon as you secrete it. So there's pockets where people are measuring acidity very closely, usually near research centers, you know, off of La Jolla with Scripps and in LA and off of Washington State. But nobody's doing a regional study from, you know, Alaska to Mexico. And it's important to do that, I think, because we got to collect a lot of data over a long period of time to notice what trends are. Right now, people are just guessing, I think.
As we saw in the United Nations report that just came out this past week on the oceans, that the acidification of the oceans since the 1970s is very dramatic. So this is very important data to collect.
I think so. You know, it's changing. The ocean's warming and the conditions are deteriorating faster than anybody's model is projecting right now. So it's worrisome.
Yeah, to say the least. So project out 5 years from now. What do you see as the grand picture of this? Now, the Western Flyer will be based, what, in Monterey?
Monterey about half the year, and the other half of the year it'll be doing its rounds. You know, I have a 15-year-old, and she came home a couple years ago from a biology class she had, and she had a picture of a cell, and she was memorizing the parts of the cell, and she looked at me and she goes, "Oh God, I can't believe you like science. It's so boring." And I looked at what she was doing, and it was really boring. Like, I just hate that they teach like that, because you can talk to any kid, any age, and tell them a story about some system, you know, like a spruce tree that sends out pheromones to tell other spruce trees that a beetle is in its bark, you know, and it attracts a wasp from miles away, and it comes and kills the beetle. Like, you just start talking about how those communities in the tide pools and the ocean live, like rickets did, and you no kid will be bored with that. You just got to tell the message the right way, and that's what I'm going to try to do. I the field trips where you see kids with clipboards and they're checking boxes. I saw a seagull. I saw a sea lion. You know, it's just anathema to me. I don't want to do any of that. And kids are smart, and they can smell fake science a mile away, and they want to be part of something real. And I you know, we'll mess up some stuff. It'll be a little bit, you know, trite sometimes, but we're going to try to hone in on stuff that is impactful.
So as you look into the future, will you also have, like, will there be like a lab or a place where the boat will go in the Sea of Cortez in the Gulf of California and in Alaska? We'll have like bases in those two locations, or just Monterey?
No, we're talking to some groups down in Santa Rosalia right now about making a base station there and involving some of the local community colleges. Some of the people down there, they're very excited about it. They, you know, they're living with the change in the condition of the sea right now, and they're very interested in teaching people about it. And the same with Alaska. You know, we've visited some of the villages there along the coast. It was just in Yakutat recently, and they, you know, every place has its own ocean health issue. Some places eelgrass depletion. Some places, you know, it's some runoff from a golf course or something, but every place is unique, and there's an opportunity to look at it and have people involved locally that can both monitor it and maybe do something about it.
And you mentioned the battery system, the electrical system. Is my understanding, are these going to be the Tesla batteries that you use?
Similar, yeah. We're using a BAE system, and I think right now the batteries are a company out of Canada called Corvus, but they're very similar to what the Tesla battery walls are like. So basically the boat can run about 5 hours at cruising speed on the battery charge. And that'll be enough for most days when we're just touring with, you know, students or teachers on board. If we're going long distance, the motor will kick on for an hour, recharge the batteries, and then turn back off. So it's kind of a hybrid system. In Monterey, the city has been very kind and are putting a series of solar panels in for us to recharge the boat with. So it's going to be, a demonstration of what's possible if you put a little thought into it.
So I'm trying to imagine what this is going to be like. The crew and the people on board, it's, what, a 75-foot vessel? Is that about the size of the Western Flyer?
Yeah, 75 feet. And, you know, at sea, it can accommodate you know, for a long journey, only, you know, 6 or 7 people. On a short day cruise, you could have 25 people on board or so.
So you, for short cruises, you would have, students and educators with them for, like, you know, kind of real science type field trip experiences?
And we've been having some, education is I don't know anything about it. I'm a geologist, but we've been having symposiums and inviting educators in, and we've learned a lot and taken a lot of information in. And it seems like the consensus is it'd be better for us to train the trainers sort of and get, you know, teachers involved in it so they can pass on, you know, the information and teach the, give them some tools to teach the stuff, and we can have an impact on more people than if we just take out a few students at a time, which we'll also do, but we're going to concentrate on teachers initially, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense, because then you're sending an army out to educate their students, so you reach many more people.
Yeah, and you know, like in Salinas, we went by there, and the number of people under 12, it's something like 70% of the kids under 12 that live about 20 miles from the ocean have never seen the ocean. So it's just, you know, it's just amazing what you have an opportunity to do. You know, it's easy. It's low hanging fruit to get people excited about some of this, yeah, if they have no experience with it.
Yeah, as an educator who works in a school with a lot of students that are, you know, coming from a poverty situation, that doesn't surprise me at all. They have just very, very limited horizons because they just don't get to go out. You know, when I was a kid, my parents took me places. And for them, you know, their lives are kind of circumscribed by home and interacting with a screen, with a video game or their phone, and that's about it.
And maybe some more insidious reasons. I was there the other day talking to some people, and I was like, why don't you guys go to the beach? It's down that road, you know, 15 miles. And they said, it's easy for you to say. We get stopped by a cop or something happens on that trip, and our whole life could change for the worse. So they don't expose themselves to unnecessary risk. So
yeah,
there's a lot of issues that I don't even think of on my normal day. And it's like, oh, okay, forget about that.
Oh yeah, certainly. Well, you know, I was thinking about, as a Steinbeck fan, and, you know, when I found out about the Western Flyer and you, you know, my first thought was, I so want to touch her someday. Do you get people that come to see the boat that are, you know, huge fans of Ed Ricketts and the book that want to see the boat?
I get contacted by so many people. It's been, I thought this was my little secret, you know, vanity program. And then I find out there's this whole world of people that are maybe up to 100 people a day come by the boat now. And some people just like lay hands on it, like they're, you know, touching some sacred artifact, and people that pin notes to it and stuff. It's really amazing how much of an impact it's had on some people. And I get letters from people all the time. It's like, that story, that book changed my life. I was doing this and then I did this. And, you know, it's just been really amazing to be involved with something that has been so impactful to people.
Yeah, I know, just for myself, you know, that book, the Log from the Sea of Cortez, and Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us, and her other books, you know, those books, when I read them, you know, led me to just a lifelong curiosity about the oceans and science. And, you know, they're those things that just kind of form you as a person. So I can see that, you know, the Western Flyer plays such a pivotal role. And briefly, do you have a favorite part of the Log of Sea of Cortez, like maybe one scene or something that, you know, really stands out to you that kind of you'd like to share with us about maybe the boat and Ed Ricketts and John?
I think, you know, one of Steinbeck's masterpieces is how he made an inanimate object that the Hansen Sea Cow, he called it, which was really a Johnson motor, seahorse motor, and how he made it a character of the boat. He said it was not only a living thing, but a mean, irritable, contemptible, vengeful, hateful living thing. It loved to ride on the back of the boat, trailing its propeller daintily in the water while we rode. And when we attacked it with a screwdriver, it fell apart and simulated death. It loved no one, trusted no one. It had no friends. And he had that kind of theme through the book where every time they needed it, it let them down. And it was amazing, his ability to make something lifeless have such a life. And yeah, that was an example of his genius.
Oh, I do remember that. That was so funny. And it would always work when they didn't need it to.
Yeah, if it was sunny and they were near the shore and the water was calm, it worked like a dream. But if they had a long haul and it was windy or cold, it didn't do anything.
Well, for you personally, as you've gone through this journey now to bringing this boat back to the sea, what's it going to be like for you when you finally get her in the water? Do you have any special plans for that? Is there going to be a christening with a bottle or anything? What are you going to do to celebrate getting her back in the water?
We're kind of taking the inaugural trip back down to the Sea of Cortez and sort of redo the whole journey, and sort of catalog some of the changes that have happened since they were there 80 years ago. So that's going to be our first trip. And there's been enough interest from scientists and artists and different people that want to go, that we're going to have a shadow vessel that goes down, and we'll have a couple of really kind of, I don't even know how to select them yet, because I've had literally a couple hundred really qualified people that want to go. So I don't know how we'll pick who gets to go, but most of us will be on the shadow vessel, just watching it, and it'll stop in these ports and it'll be a series of lectures and demonstrations and activities.
Well, John, it's just been a joy to talk to you about this incredible project of yours of restoring the Western Flyer, the famous boat from John Steinbeck's The Log from the Sea of Cortez. And I would just wish you the best of luck with her. And thank you for turning this into an opportunity for science education, because that was the main reason when I saw what you were doing is why I wanted you on the show.
Well, I appreciate the invite, and it's always fun to talk about. So thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, John Gregg. You can learn more about the project to restore the Western Flyer at westernflyer.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.